All right, the case we'll hear next is Barlow v. Colgate-Palmolive. And I guess, Ms. Gay, we'll hear from you first. Is that it?
May it please the Court, my name is Faith Gay, and I represent Colgate. Good afternoon. I believe it's the afternoon.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, as this Court is aware, Colgate removed two individual cases to the District Court of Maryland, and there were remand papers filed by the plaintiffs here. The plaintiffs told the federal court in no uncertain terms that there was, in fact, no diversity, which was the only basis for removal that Colgate asserted, because the non-diverse defendants, the plaintiffs planned and hoped and would proceed against them.
Would or could?
Would and could. And to that extent, Your Honor, they presented, and I think it's probably worth going through in a little bit of detail, the evidence that was presented to the court in writing. Before I do that, let me make clear how sharp the turn was. Remand was obtained on the basis, solely on the basis, that there was a possibility that there would be cases to be made against the non-diverse plaintiffs. 8 days after remand was obtained, the plaintiffs walked over to state court and made it crystal clear to the state court judge in writing and then in oral presentations thereafter that it was a one-defendant case, that there was not even the suggestion of any evidence against any of the previously non-diverse defendants, and that any suggestion otherwise was patently frivolous. And let me just be clear, since the court has asked a question about what the record shows.
In other words, that basically you're saying they said on that date there's an impossibility.
Correct.
Of having an action.
Well, let me.
Is that necessarily true for the earlier time period? The statement was made.
Well, the
that it was an impossibility. I find those words sort of interesting. The glimmer of hope, impossibility, and I'm. You know, we're dealing in both instances with words of counsel. The court is sitting there to make the determination of whether it has jurisdiction. And it has the option of taking whatever statements, whatever word it wants to take. And a counsel can get up and basically say anything. You know, this is possible. And I would think, having sort of been on the other side of this, the word possible, a lot of things are possible. There's songs that say all things are possible. And so it really puts it in the vein of saying possibility that something ought to go off in the antennas of the judge to say, well, tell me something other than you see it. Was that not done here, or did the judge just heard the word possibility and says, okay, I'll send it back?
Well, Judge, when the remand motions were decided on the pleading, so it's solely on the written record, which is before the court. But to address...
You mean these representations didn't have anything to do with it?
No.
I thought you said they orally represented.
No, Your Honor. The representations in the remand motions, there were two remand motions for each of these cases put before the federal district court, and the representations that there were. And let me just go into a little more.
Finish that. You said it was decided on the pleading.
Yes, it was decided
on the statement of counsel.
Well, it was the pleadings were signed by counsel, of course, yeah,
but,
Your Honor.
So it's the
which
pleadings
was false
that you have a problem with.
What was?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
That's what got me perked up. I thought you said they went to the federal court and said something to the federal court in an argument.
They did. Here's what.
Well,
was,
but then you said it was decided. On the papers.
On the papers
well,
submitted for remand.
If it was decided on the papers, then what was said at the hearing couldn't have anything to do with it.
Well, let me.
Are you abandoning the contention that what was said at the hearing has something to do with it?
No, Your Honor, there was no hearing in federal court. Remand
motions.
There was
no argument?
There was no argument.
There was no. I thought there was an argument. Where was the argument?
There was an argument in representations made in the state court, which I'll
that
get to.
That was their argument in state court. So the statements in the federal court were in writing.
Correct.
And the statements in the state court were oral.
They were both.
They were both.
Yes, okay. Your Honor. So
right.
If I could just go through the sequence very quickly
ask you,
for the court.
Before we get too far in this, to try to clarify what we have before us. I thought that your motions under Rule 11 and 63B were filed in the district court, and the district court dismissed them because it concluded it didn't have jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you've appealed that. And so we don't decide the merits of the remand or even the substance of the fraud here, do we? We just decide whether the district court had jurisdiction to consider these.
There's two issues there. Your Honor, with respect to what
As to each rule, Rule 11 and Rule 60B3.
That's correct.
Did the district court have jurisdiction?
The district court said that under...
If we rule on those, that's the end of the case.
Correct.
We say yes or no on either one of them.
The district court held that under 1447, there is no ability or jurisdiction...
I understand what it did, but I just want to understand what the issue is before us, because you seem to start to slide into whether you had a good claim on your sanctions or in your fraud. And I'm just suggesting whether you had a good claim or not, you made a motion that was dismissed because of lack of jurisdiction.
Right.
And so our task is to decide whether the district court had jurisdiction to consider your motions.
That's
Isn't
correct,
that right?
Your Honor. Correct. And so with regard to that, we did not appeal the remand order. What we brought were two separate motions, one under Rule 11 and one under Rule 60B3.
And the
district court held argument and held that because 1447 prohibits review of a remand order, it could not consider the relief requested on those two motions. And our position on this appeal is that this court is certainly permitted to vacate a fraudulently procured remand order.
Yeah, but we're not trying to do that, are we? You just said the district court ruled it couldn't reach either motion. Didn't have jurisdiction on Rule 11 or 60B3, correct?
The relief requested
and
was prohibited by 1447.
And the district court, are you telling us the district court coupled them together?
Yes.
It denied them both or dismissed them both on the same reasoning.
Right.
If we say that he was wrong on both of those, that doesn't have any impact on your remand order.
Well, yes, Your Honor,
it does not. All we're doing is saying he was wrong on the answer on saying he didn't have any jurisdiction, and he has to consider the two motions.
Well, that is one option, Judge Keogh.
Well, there's not any question about whether that's an option or not. Anyway, I interrupted Judge Niemeyer, and I apologize.
And a second option, Judge King, given that the record is completely clear.
Why would we rule in the first instance on that? If he had jurisdiction, Rule 11, he can go after the lawyers for misconduct in their pleadings and representations to him, or the two judges could, and do whatever need to do to justify, rectify the system. Under 60B3, if he has jurisdiction, he can decide whether there was a fraud or misrepresentation made to the court that warrants some relief on the remand issue.
Well,
but we don't have to decide any of that other stuff.
Well, at the very least, you are correct that 1447 does not prohibit the district court from considering our motions. That is clear legal error. That's one thing. But the record is clear enough as to what the district court would have ruled here that this court can vacate
remand. You don't want us to send it back. You want us to rule now on the merits or lack of merits or whatever of the remand order. It sounded to me like you also wanted us to say, as a sanction, you ought to get jurisdiction in the federal court.
Well, no, as a sanction, we're not asking for jurisdiction. We're asking for vacatur of the remand. Because it was fraudulently procured.
I mean, you can vacate it, but don't have jurisdiction. Subject matter jurisdiction is important. You got to have that.
Well, Your Honor,
in order to be able for the court to even consider. If I'm following what Judge Niemeyer and what Judge King is alluding to, the motions that are before us, the question is whether we have the court had jurisdiction. Once we decide that, then the relief that the court can give is a whole different matter. And if the relief can encompass vacating the remand, that may be a totally different issue. I'm not sure that fits within the type of relief. You may, in fact, have some type of, like, attorney's fees or something that's collateral. Right. Maybe to deal with, doesn't deal with the merits. Even in a Rule 11 sanction, you could sanction a lawyer, you can do all kinds of stuff. That doesn't necessarily mean that you get to undo the underlying relief that every precedent out there says you can't do. You can't go back and because like I started out this, it may have been getting into it a bit. The basis of it is that the judge made that decision, and it's already been determined. When he makes that decision to send it back, cannot be reviewed. Right,
Your Honor,
wrong,
we're not,
however it got there.
And, Your Honor,
it, and if it was fraud or whatever happened in the court, and the fraud is based on a representation of counsel, it was a decision to accept that representation. And therein is your problem. But maybe you get the relief. Maybe collaterally we can look at Rule 11 things, but it doesn't necessarily mean we now got to say, okay, vacate the remand.
Your Honor, you're correct. You can send it just back to the district court. That is one method of relief. However, the record is clear enough about the fraud, and there's no question that under
Rule... What motion would we be deciding then? You would, you had a Rule 11 and a Rule 63B.
Right.
Rule 63B says when there's fraud, you can open up a judgment or order or proceeding. The question is, the district court didn't decide that. Well, he had this hypothetical comment afterwards.
Correct.
On what he would do. But we're going to vacate that if we were to send it back, too, and have the court address the motions. You can put in whatever you want. You can give an evidence and make your arguments. But the sanctions for, say you win on your motions, the sanctions for that still have to be decided by the district court, not us, right?
Your Honor, again, you are correct. At the very least, the district court was in error in not considering the motions and saying that 1447
blocked
them.
That's all we have before us, because that is the operative order. The court says, I don't have jurisdiction. I've sent the case away.
Correct, but the court did not reach the merits, but he did indicate how he would have ruled nevertheless.
But we can't rule on that type of thing, can we?
Well,
how can we decide the motions up here and decide the appropriate remedies? We don't have anything from the district court to review.
I'm not sure you understand the function of the appellate court. If the court didn't think it had jurisdiction and we tell him he had it, then he has to rule. And then the loser can, if once it's a final order, can come back up here.
Your Honor,
impose sanctions on lawyers or the 60B3, then maybe there's another appeal.
And the vacatur of the remand order is a dicey question because it looks on its face 63B may authorize that.
Correct.
But there is also the whole concept of normally 63B applies to a judgment that's in the court that you're applying to. And now the case has been gone to the state court. Hypothetically, for instance, if the state tried the case to final judgment, and the final judgment had appeal time gone by, and then you found fraud in the removal, and came back and the district court says, I'm going to vacate the remand because of the fraud, what happens to the state judgment?
Well, Judge, just to be clear.
It may be without jurisdiction, but this is a more of a dicey question that you need to explore and argue before the district court, and we don't have the record or the ruling to review on that. We just have one operative ruling. I don't have jurisdiction to consider these motions because I sent the case away.
Okay. Well, as to your point and Judge King's point, certainly you can send this back because under 1447, the district court did have authority to consider the motions, was not without jurisdiction to do that. But on top of that...
You just say that, but isn't that the issue? I mean, we're going to accept your bald allegations. Is there a case that says we can?
With regard to 1447, there are a number of cases, Judge.
Well, I know there are, actually. I'm asking it hypothetically, but I think you're still got the wrong issue on the table. You want us to vacate the remand order.
Yes, and again, Judge, the reason I say that is, well... The district court indicated that it would not rule on the sanctions motion, would not grant sanctions no matter what, even if it had jurisdiction. He said the fact that there were two attorneys and two different locations, he wouldn't have granted sanctions anyway.
Are you suggesting,
that is also error.
Are you suggesting that we might consider, we have to address the jurisdictional question. Is it your concern that because the district court appears to already have prejudged the 60B3 issue, that it would be futile to argue it before that district court?
Your Honor, the district court prejudged the entire sanctions motions, both Rule 11 inherent ability to grant sanctions and the Rule 60, and indicated that it would not have granted sanctions because the two representations were made by...
So you want us to consider the backup, the conditional order, as an operative appealed order and say the court abused its discretion?
I'm saying the court can do that because it's clear how the district court would have ruled. Certainly the court does not have to do it, but it can do it here.
Could we send it back, or could we send it to another judge as a protection against the district court rather than a rebuke, because it appears that the district court may already have decided it, and just to protect the district court's ability to address it on a clean slate?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. But
would that address your concern?
That would address my concern.
You haven't asked for that, though, to this point.
No, we have not asked for that. That's correct. We think the record is very clear as to what the district court would do. And there's
Ms. Kay?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
morning. Maybe it's good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You know, I feel like I owe my colleagues an apology, because you and I both well know that apparently this is the worst opinion I've ever authored as a judge, because you and I both know that when I said in my panel opinion that we affirm the district court's conclusion that it lacked jurisdiction, what that meant, and I apologize for not saying it more clearly, what that meant is that the only thing Colgate wanted from the district court and now wants from this court, and that's why you've been having so much difficulty with my colleagues this morning, the only thing you want, as you said in your brief before the panel, and as you've repeated in your brief before the en banc court, the only thing you want is restoration of federal jurisdiction. And in fact, at the panel, the dissent and the majority actually agreed that there's no way, as a sanction under Rule 11, to restore federal jurisdiction. No dispute at the panel level about that. Nor is there any dispute, of course, that in a removal case, a federal district court has the authority, the jurisdiction, to impose sanctions on counsel. No dispute about that. But you could care less if Judge Nickerson imposed $50,000 penalty on these lawyers or their law firm. You don't want that. And that was clear before the panel, and I think it's clear this morning. You say exactly in your brief, the only non-abuse of discretion, the only non-abuse of discretion in this case would be a restoration of federal jurisdiction. It's right there in your brief.
Your Honor, if I may.
Have I said anything that's incorrect? And if so, what have I
said? Your Honor, I do disagree that we seek federal jurisdiction as a penalty here. What we seek...
Well, whether you call it as a penalty, sanction you want. You don't want these lawyers to be, their careers to be trashed. You haven't filed a complaint with the Maryland Attorney Grievance Commission. You haven't referred them to the District of Maryland's Admissions and Disciplinary Committee. You don't really want to harm these lawyers by alleging that they made misrepresentations as officers of the court. You don't want to go there.
Well,
what you want is you want your client to be back in the District of Maryland so that you can then file a motion to transfer this asbestos case to the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, where it will join all the other 88,000 asbestos cases.
No, Your Honor, all of that is incorrect.
Okay.
Your Honor. But may I just back up for a moment? As far as the motion to transfer in this case belonging in a multi-district, that is not true as far as I know. These are single cases. These are not traditional asbestos cases.
Let's stay focused on what that might have been a little bit of additional information that Judge Davis is providing. But his point seems to go to the heart of where we're going. If the issue here is whether the court has jurisdiction to determine sanctions, you want us to go to the second issue, and that is, what relief can the judge offer? And you say we ought to reach it, and we probably should. But I think the answer to that question is, he can give any release except remand this case, because that's going to the merits of this case. There's law that says no. That's what I think. But the bottom line is, which Judge Davis, I appreciate his explanation of his opinion. He's clarified some basis for it significantly. And I don't know if the dissent in that case agrees with it, but it seems to make sense. If that's all you asked before the court, then that's probably problematic, if that's all you asked before. If you simply want jurisdiction, which the court may be in a position to do, says go back, yeah, you have jurisdiction, no, then we'll make the determination as to what relief is available. Because even in a sanction, even in imposing sanction, you may not give relief for which the court could not give, I mean, if you don't have the authority to do so.
Ms. Gay.
And that's foreclosed by precedent. I'm sorry.
Your Honor, please. There's
Ms. Gay, having written to the set, listen to me and read the tea leaves up here. They want to send your sanctions motion back because, at least I believe, the judge had jurisdiction, and send the 60B3 motion back to see if you can convince a district judge. And the question is going to come down, as Judge Niemeyer said, what is the claim? Is the claim the judgment or something in the case, or is it a right to be in federal court? Is that a claim? I don't know the answer to that question. But what you're hearing here is that they don't want to decide, except the jurisdictional issue, as to sanctions and as to 60B3.
And, Your Honor,
simply as I can put it, I wrote the dissent in your favor.
And with regard to that, under 1447, there is nothing in that statute that precludes a court from considering whether there has been a fraudulently obtained judgment.
But you're going back and want us to decide the facts.
that's a jurisdictional question, Your Honor.
Yeah.
With regard to 1447, the district court held that 1447 is what precluded
jurisdiction. Do we have any cases where a court has called or reconsidered a remand order?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And how's that function mechanically? Is the reconsideration by the federal court then transmitted to the state court and they stop prosecuting, or what?
No, well, again, the relief we are seeking
is... No, not what you're seeking, these other cases that you said.
Yes, the other cases have reconsidered issues that are collateral.
No, I'm talking about there's two motions you have here, and I think it's probably good to get the two a distinction on the table. The first one is a Rule 11 sanctions motion.
Correct.
And that can sanction the parties and the attorneys. But then you also have a 63B motion, which is to vacate an order based on fraud.
Correct.
And the order you want vacated is the remand order.
Correct.
And that was filed against that. Now, my question is, if the court said it didn't have jurisdiction on that, and, of course, I think 63B certainly is pretty broad in this sense. But my question is, if the court considers a 63B order and decides there was fraudulent joinder, can it vacate the remand order and thereby recover the case?
Your Honor, what we're asking is slightly different from that, if the court will bear with me.
No, I'd like you to answer my
question. That's what I'm trying to say. What we're asking for is a determination under Rule 60.
Martin, can you answer his question, yes or no?
Yes, I can, Your Honor.
Is it yes or no? That would help me.
We're not asking for reconsideration of the remand merits itself, is what I'm saying, Your Honor. We're asking for a different...
What are you asking for in the 63B motion?
We're asking for the order to be vacated because of fraud.
What I said.
Right, correct.
My hypothetical had you your motion was directed at the remand order, and you wanted vacated under 63B.
Right, but we don't want a reconsideration of the merits of the remand orders itself. We want it vacated because of the fraud.
No, we want it vacated, but if...
Vacated because of the fraud.
But you still haven't answered these questions.
Now, if you vacate the remand order under 63B, what happens mechanically in these other cases.
If the plaintiffs have some reason to remove the case, if they have some other basis for to remand it again, fine. But right now, there's no basis there.
The case is before the state court. The state court is proceeding on a remand order. The federal court revokes its remand order. What happens? Does the court then send that order to the state and the state stops prosecuting the case?
Right. Well, right now, both of these cases are in the midst of discovery.
Why don't you answer I don't want this case. I want to know the principles applicable.
Right. I understand.
Help me out. Otherwise, you're not going to advance the ball at all. We're talking about a concept of relative jurisdictions between federal and state courts.
If the remand order is vacated, it comes back to the federal court.
And where's that? Is there authority for that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's that?
With regard to Rule 60, an order that
I know that can be. But I'm just talking about we have a particular type of problem here because the case was sent back to the state and the state is prosecuting the case on behalf of pursuant to that order.
Correct.
The state has general jurisdiction, can prosecute it. Now, how are you going to stop the state court?
Well, if the remand order is vacated, the cases are still in federal court.
Well,
but that puts the cart before the horse again. We keep going around in this circle. You say that what you want is, or what I thought we had established early on, is that the threshold question is jurisdiction. So if we decide that the district court erred in concluding that it lacked jurisdiction, then all it does is go back to consider, it doesn't do anything about the case heading back to
correct. Court. It goes back to the district court for consideration of the Rule 60 and Rule 11 motions.
And Rule 11 and the Rule 60 motion.
Yeah.
Correct.
Consider both of them.
Correct.
Sanction the lawyers, and then the court then could conduct appropriate proceedings and then decide whether to grant relief.
Correct.
Under Rule 60B3.
Right.
If you prove the fraud and misrepresentation, perhaps then he could vacate the
correct,
remand
Your Honor.
Order. But that would be something that the district court would have to do, happen up here.
But I didn't understand that to be the question. I understood the question to be what happens physically and system-wise, what happens? There's this state, this case is now in state court. What happens to the state court case?
Let me help you out on that question. You're not exactly correct that if you get a vacature, it's back in federal court. But the way you would enforce that is use the Anti-Injunction Act. And this is one of those exceptions where you could enjoin the state court. And clearly, this court has decided that issue before. I think Mr. Maxwell wrote the issue. That's the way it'd be done.
Sir, is that 2283?
The statute?
The Injunction Act. It's a federal statute.
Yeah.
Preserve jurisdiction.
That's right. That's what it is.
Okay.
But, Your Honors,
That starts to address my question because the 60 motion, 60B3, is not a sanction order. It's a motion to reconsider an order that was entered by fraud.
Correct.
And in this case, fraudulent joinder, which I'm not sure the district court got right either, doesn't require intent. Of defrauding somebody, deceiving. Fraudulent joinder means joining somebody for the purposes of defeating jurisdiction.
Correct, which is exactly what happened here.
Well, I understand that, and it seems to me you didn't make that case very well to the court below, but if there's a fraudulent joinder, you remember the case against Pete Rose in Cincinnati? You know, they filed it in state court, and they sued the Cincinnati Reds and Pete Rose. And the district, it was removed, and the district court separated the two cases. This is fraudulent joinder. It's staying up here in federal court. And that is a concept where you join somebody, not because they're the real party in interest, but to defeat jurisdiction.
Correct. And that's exactly what happened here, Your Honor. And as I was starting.
All right. But the question, really, Judge Shedd got to the point that I was asking, and maybe Judge Floyd has answered it. The question is, if you get a vacatur, you get a reconsideration of this on the 63B, you vacate the remand order, mechanically, the question is, what happens then? I mean, you know, we have respect between the states and the feds, and obviously the federal judge can send a copy of the order to the state, and maybe the state will abide by it, but maybe not. And then you get the question is, how far long does it go before you have real prejudice because you have discovery in the state? Let me ask you this. Did you file a motion to dismiss the fraudulently joined parties in the state court?
We did, Your Honor.
You did?
We filed, and we also filed summary.
No, on remand, after the case went back and the lawyer said, we don't really have a claim against these others. We just really want Colgate. Did you file a motion to dismiss based on that?
All those defendants are out now.
Well, you can remove within 30 days after that.
Well, Your Honor, it's as far as we understand that we cannot remove
you can
again.
If a court tells you it's not removable, you go back to state court. And once it becomes removable, you have 30 days within which to remove it. But there's a time period on that.
Your Honor, as we understand that...
When it first becomes removable.
Your Honor, at this point in time, 1446 has been amended to have an extended time period where fraud has been shown. But we are not subject to that because that was only applies...
No, I'm talking about the principle that a case that's not removable when it's filed still can be removed to federal court once it becomes removable. If the court dismisses three defendants who create diversity, at that point you can remove it.
And Your Honor, with regard to that, we have filed motions in both federal and state court that address this. And the state courts...
No, did you file a new motion to remove after it became removable?
No, Your Honor. Not as of yet.
Did your 30 days expire?
I don't think...
You don't have to file a motion either. You just have to remove it on removal. So you should file a notice of removal. But if you did that, that might render the 60B3 motion, it's up here, moot. All we'd have to is the Rule 11 stuff.
Your Honor, may I reserve some
time
for rebuttal?
What's that?
You can answer his question.
Yes, I mean, Your Honor, if we can file such a motion, we would.
Are you still within the 30-day period the judge talked about?
Your Honor, I am not aware that we are eligible for such a motion.
Is there complete diversity now in the state court?
There is complete diversity now.
You could remove that case once it became completely diverse, but you have a time period.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Cooperman. Excuse me, Mr. Underwood.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors, and may it please the court, Jeff Udermull, on behalf of the appellees Joyce Barlow and Clara Mosco, and I'm here today with my colleagues Russell Smaus and Craig Silverman. Your Honors,
the court does have jurisdiction over those motions, doesn't it? I mean, it can decide the Rule 11 sanctions.
Your Honor, we do concede that under Cooter and Gale, there is jurisdiction under Rule 11, at least.
And under the rule, face of the rule, 60 can be decided any time if one fraud is shown. 60B3, right?
Your Honor, under 60B3, the issue is there's no jurisdiction.
Why? The Congress gave the court the ability on the basis of fraud to review any order at any time. Isn't that what the rule says?
Your Honor, there's a bad faith exception in 1446.
No, I'm talking about 60B3. The base language of it says that any judgment, order, or proceeding can be set aside for fraud at any time.
Under Cooter and Gale, Your Honor, the distinction is made between a motion for sanctions and a motion for modification of the, a motion that requires modification of the original order.
You're missing my question. Mm-hmm. My question is, you can set aside any judgment or order that was entered on the basis of fraud. And the argument they're making is that the remand order was obtained by fraud. And if the court were so defined, it could set aside the order. I don't understand where there's a lack of jurisdiction. Any order that a federal judge enters can be reviewed by that federal judge under 60B3 if the right showing is made.
There can be no vacator here. because of 1447D.
I'm talking about, well, under 60B3, you vacate the order you entered.
But there's no jurisdiction under 60B3 to vacate because of 1447D prohibition on review.
Well, I think you're having a problem responding to Judge Niemeyer. Clearly, the issue here is, does 1447 trump 60B3, or does 60B3 trump 1447? Isn't that the problem? Now, Judge Floyd has helpfully said, well, what could happen is we could use the Anti-Injunction Act, and a federal judge could issue an injunctive order after granting a 60B3 motion. And I think the question that Judge Niemeyer put to Ms. Gay that she never answered was, is there any case out there in the 234 years, or I guess the 229 years of diversity jurisdiction since the first judicial act of 1789, has any court ever done such a thing?
Well,
no.
The answer is no. The answer is no. Colgate cites no cases holding that a 60B3 vacator did not violate.
He didn't ask you if anybody cited cases. He asked you if there were any cases. And the answer to him is?
The answer is no. Your Honor,
has a court ever vacated or reversed itself on a remand order?
Yes, but not on a 60B3 vacator.
Forget the reasons. What happened in that case? When they reverse themselves on a remand order, what happens?
Well, what happened in the Tremonte case was there was a vacator without review, and that exemplifies that principle, but it did not involve 60B3. And in that case, the district court that had failed to properly consider its own recusal in the remand order was ordered to then reconsider its recusal decision. But it could not, and
no, my question is, I don't know, maybe I'm not expressing it well enough, but I'm trying to find out, the removal statute is a very sophisticated interplay between state court systems and federal court systems. And my question is, once a federal court remands a case to state court and then decides it did it wrong and wants to review it and changes its mind, can it do it, number one? And if it does change its mind, what happens?
It's not exactly correct to say there's not any cases out there where 60B3 was used to vacate. You have Aquamar, you had Tremonti, and I mean, there are cases out there. I didn't realize that question was going to pop up, but it can be done.
Yes, Your Honor, and the distinction between those cases and this case is that Tremonti, Aquamar, and Williams v. B. Miller, none of those involved 60B3 vacators. And
well, that might be a distinction without a difference.
Well,
what Judge Niemeyer is getting at, and I understand, is there are cases where it's been done. You said it was done because you had a disqualified, or a judge that may have been disqualified, who entered the order. So they backed up, right?
Well, that's right, Your Honor. And each one of those cases used phrase.
Idea would be that the order was procured by fraud on the court. And nobody wants to reward a fraud feeser with something, so you unwind it and try to clean it up.
And a fraud feeser, for your information, is a subclass of tort feeser.
Each one of those cases that's been cited, Tremonti, Aquamar, and B. Miller, each one of those cases was decided on the basis that the vacator was a quote-unquote essentially ministerial task.
Let me ask this question of you. I'm going to try to get to the answer. Maybe you've given it. I've understood the question. I don't think I understand the answer. In a case, not your case, in a case where there has been a vacating of the remand order, so the case is already back in state court, what then happens to effectuate the order of the federal district court? What happens?
I would think there would be a...
You think of that, or do you know?
A re-removal. A motion for removal.
by the way, I probably shouldn't admit this. I think actually as a district court, I was reversed on remand by the Fourth Circuit one time, those narrow cases of review. But might it not just be there's a, the court would order, district court would order you back into court to defend or prosecute that case. And that might be state court litigation going at the same time, the exact same case. Can't that happen? Then you fall to doctrines of withholding or, you know, abstention. Isn't that, might that not happen? I mean, you can have cases, identical cases going through the state system and the federal system, can't you? I'm asking. Or if you don't know, then you don't know.
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
Could I ask a slightly different question? Does, in reviewing a motion for vacature, does that necessarily involve a review of the merits of the case?
Yes, under 60B3. Now, if it's not a 60B3 vacator, such as in Tremonte, Aquamore, and B. Miller, then you can have vacator without review. But necessarily, where it's not, like those cases, an essentially ministerial task, what you have here is a required judgment call. It's a in order to have vacator, a necessary predicate is to have a judgment call on the very same fraudulent joinder issue that was already decided below.
And what defendant, what defendant would never file a 60B3 post-remand if you could get a hearing in federal court for a do-over on a fraudulent joinder claim? Why would a defendant never file a 60B motion? If what you get to do is relitigate whether there was fraudulent joinder, I'm dumbfounded.
Could I finish, and maybe you could respond to them both at the same time if you remember them. My concern, or my question, was predicated on the fact that the basis for the fraud claim may not arise, as I think is true here, until after the remand. Is that correct?
There was no basis for fraud here.
No, I didn't say basis. I said, or what I meant to say is basis for a claim of fraud arose because of the statements that were made in federal court and conflicting statements made in state court. Is that correct so far?
Would you agree? Go ahead and answer.
No, if you can answer it, that would help.
60B3 motion does not focus on the merits or the correctness of an order, but rather the manner in which the order is obtained. Do you agree with that proposition?
No, Your Honor, because 60B3 requires proof of a quote-unquote meritorious fraudulent joinder defense.
But meritorious claim of fraud, not claim on the merits.
No, it's a meritorious, it's not a meritorious claim of fraud, it's a meritorious claim of fraudulent joinder.
You're not reading 60B3. 60B3 lets the court open up an order that was entered on the pursuant to fraud on the court.
But if the order is one of remand for non-fraudulent joinder, the merits question is whether there was fraudulent joinder.
Yes. In fact, at page 55 in Judge Floyd's dissent, he noted that Colgate must, quote, demonstrate the existence of a meritorious defense to the remand orders, namely that the Maryland in-state defendants were fraudulently joined.
Exactly. So it's a do-over.
It does.
What Judge Duncan was asking you about, if she'll indulge me, what she was asking you is where the evidence of alleged fraud comes up in state court. Because that's what we have here. We have a claim of fraudulent joinder. The district court, two different district judges in the District of Maryland, didn't buy the claim of fraudulent joinder. Each judge sent it back to state court. And then based on something that happened in state court, a pleading, by the way, right? It was a pleading. It wasn't something that was said orally.
Correct.
It was in a pleading in state court. Now the defendant comes back to state, to federal court, who knows, 2 weeks later, 4 weeks later, 6 months later, and says, now I have evidence to support my fraudulent joinder claim. And so to get around 1447, The defendant is relying on 60B3 saying, let's vacate it because the order was obtained by fraud, but it's an order of remand based on the failure of proof, because the burden unquestionably is on the defendant, both to establish federal jurisdiction and to show fraudulent joinder. It's a do-over. You can say it's on the merits of the order, but the merits of the order of remand is whether there was fraudulent joinder.
That's right. It's inextricably intertwined with the very same issue that was already decided.
What Judge Davis is saying, you agree?
Absolutely.
All right. Let me ask.
I have a fundamental question. I want to go back to something we started out. I got thrown off track. Don't you look at this order that the judge that we're appealing for on 1106 and 1108. And we started out saying the judge says he didn't have jurisdiction. It's not clear to me that in those orders he's not saying he didn't have jurisdiction. He not only addresses the motion, he conducts a hearing on the motion. And his problem is he's saying, I don't know what relief you want. And then once he gets in that hearing, the other side stands up, we just want a remand. And then he then says here that I don't have jurisdiction to grant that request. He doesn't say I don't have jurisdiction to decide the motion. In fact, these motions were denied. They were not dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. So I think the issue is back to what we sort of got off track with. I think the issue here is, does the court have jurisdiction to grant the request to strike this matter and remand it? And that's where this trial judge went with it. And then the only surplus here is he got into the business after the second sentence in, next to the last paragraph, he gets into business of, well, it's not sanctionable conduct. But the initial determination on jurisdiction is he is saying, I don't have jurisdiction to grant the request to strike and remand.
That's right.
And that's the issue on appeal here from this. I don't think it's just jurisdiction. I was led to believe that from the beginning, but Judge Davis, you sort of had that different. But that order, as it reads, it looks clear to me, this judge exercises jurisdiction, has a hearing, and denies the motion. He doesn't dismiss him. And based upon that, that denial is based on the fact that he believes that the relief being requested, he can't give.
Well, Your Honor,
is that the posture of this case?
What happened with the order is Judge...
I'm looking at the order. It is right there.
Judge Nickerson did not say that he had no jurisdiction on a Rule 11. So sanctions. I call that Rule 11.
He didn't have jurisdiction on any of the motions. He conducted a hearing on them. And then that's when they brought up the Rule 60B business here, because that brings in the relief to send it back. He says, I can't give that relief. Rule 60 is being brought here for purposes of relief, not for purposes of sanction. The purpose is to get some relief.
Well, that's right. What he said about the sanctions, the Rule 11 sanctions, is that the request had been abandoned. It was very clear in this order. He comes back to it. It's in the first paragraph. It's in the last paragraph on the first page, 1106. First, he says, defendants clarified that relief sought for this court was for this court to vacate. And he says it's not available because of 1447.
He says that's the only sanction they want.
It's the only sanction.
And I don't have jurisdiction to give that particular relief.
Because it's under 60.
And then he denies the motions.
Just a little bit of a twist on that. If we conclude that the court had jurisdiction to address both motions and to potentially grant the relief, what should we do? Hypothetically, if we can come to that conclusion, what should we do with the court's statement that if it were considered the merits, it would deny it?
Well, it was not an abuse of discretion to so find. There was certainly...
No, my question is, what should we do with that? Should we review it or let the judge develop the appropriate sanctions?
No, with regard to vacater, he properly determined that there was no jurisdiction.
You have to stick with my hypothetical, which is, if we were to conclude he has jurisdiction on both the Rule 11 and the 60B3,
right?
And what else should we do if we were the obvious possibility? If we were to conclude that, we send it back. But then my question addresses: if we send it back, what should we be doing with the court's statement that even if it had jurisdiction, it would deny the motions?
Well, Your Honor, I would say if the court were to find that it had jurisdiction, Judge Nickerson had jurisdiction under both 11 and 60, he should still be affirmed under abuse of discretion standard.
That shouldn't be your answer. Your answer should be the court decided it has jurisdiction. There's no statement in here that says, if I have jurisdiction, then I would do this. What he says is, I'm going to decide. He has a hearing. He actually puts those motions out. And then he says, what's the relief? And the only thing he says is, I can't give you that relief. He doesn't say, I don't have jurisdiction over these motions. He, in fact, considers the motions and denies them. There's no if in this.
Well, he says, on the basis that the court held, this was in Lowe, the entry of a remand order divested the federal court of jurisdiction.
What am I reading?
I don't know, but I have
that. On 1106, that's true. I believe that Judge Nickerson
found... But he's only going to the basis of the relief in that paragraph. He's not talking about the motion. He's talking about the relief being asked for there.
Well, that's
in the first paragraph, he's dealing specifically with the motion. That sentence comes in the second paragraph. F.E. says, such relief is not available. The court has no jurisdiction to grant that relief. And he used the basis of that in the Lowe case.
He's talking about...
He's not talking about the motions.
I think he's talking about both under 11 or 60, there's no jurisdiction to vacate. And that's because vacater is not an appropriate sanction under Rule 11. It simply isn't.
Do you think that the district court had jurisdiction under 60B3, yes or no?
No, because it would necessarily violate 1447 because of the meritorious defense requirement.
You don't think the argument could be that he had jurisdiction, he properly exercised that jurisdiction, and refused to grant the merit relief that the other side asked? You don't think that? You think he just didn't have jurisdiction to even entertain such a request?
It goes on to give the basis that he didn't think he had any business considering it.
What he's saying there is even if there had not been an abandonment of Rule 11 sanctions, mm-hmm. which he found there was, but even if there was not an abandonment of Rule 11 sanctions, he would deny them for the reason that it is a markedly different litigation context. That doesn't address
my point, which is, as I understood the order, and so I was going back to look at it, I thought he was denying the relief because the entry of a remand order divests the court of jurisdiction, which is why he cites Lowe, holding that removal statutes preclude reconsideration of a remand order.
Well, that's right. I think some of the confusion arises because Colgate sought vacater under both 11 and 60. And they kind of realized...
What is it in 1447 that you think denies the court the right to enter a 60B3 order?
The meritorious defense requirement. And it runs smack into...
What, read the language there. What's it say?
Of
1447.
An order remanding a case to the state court from which it was removed is not reviewable on appeal or otherwise.
Well, that's review on appeal. But that doesn't have anything to do with the district court's...
Well, or otherwise. The or otherwise language has been interpreted to include... reviewed by the district court as well.
By whom? The otherwise means...
For certain.
Includes mandamus.
Yeah. I don't have the case citation, Your Honor, but that has been clearly established, I believe, in the Fourth Circuit, that broad language includes both that the or otherwise...
The district court was relying on Roe, exactly as Judge Duncan asked you, saying that once I've entered the remand order, the case is gone, I'm divested of jurisdiction, therefore I can't act further.
There's a distinction between low and...
Can you just answer my question? Isn't that what the district court was doing?
Well, certainly the district court cited low.
And what did it say after it cited low?
In low, the Fourth Circuit looked to the language of the federal removal statute. And what is valid in its court's reliance on low is the fact that there can be no vacator under Rule 60. But there can't be any vacator under Rule 11 for another reason.
You keep coming back to your argument. I'm trying to find out what the district court did, and you're not helping me. I asked you, didn't the court appear to say that once it issued the remand order, it was divested of jurisdiction?
Not with regard to the Rule 11 request for vacator or the Rule 11 request for sanctions. The court did not rely on a lack of jurisdiction to deny vacator under Rule 11.
Where does it say that in there?
And how could that be based on 1447, which you tell us makes things not reviewable on appeal or otherwise to anyone, to any forum?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you give me the question again?
Well, why don't you start with Judge Niemeyer's and Judge King's and then work your way around to mine?
My question is simply that it seems to me very clear, and it's too bad we're having so much trouble getting to understand what was done, and we're not even getting to the real tough issues as to what to do. But in this case, the court cited low and said that under 1447D, it construed the otherwise, like you said, it couldn't review it again. On the basis, the court held that the entry of a remand order divested the federal court of jurisdiction. In low, like the instant case, the defendant challenged the remand on the basis of fraud and joint. Now, isn't that a jurisdictional issue? He's saying, I don't have the power to see it anymore. It's gone.
Only as to vacator.
You need to answer Judge Niemeyer's question directly and point to the first sentence and then point to the word C, low, which lets you know he's referring to low to support that first sentence, which is the grant is only on, the reason he says he doesn't have jurisdiction is that he can't have jurisdiction to grant that request. See, low, all that stuff he says about low, he then puts in there. Now, I'm going to give Judge Nicholson credit for this. He knows, he has to know this law as well as what we're talking about. And I think he put that low decision in there to explain that little extra why he's saying that first sentence. Because it then goes to the next paragraph, and that's what he's saying. He's essentially saying the only sanction being sought was for the court to strike remand orders. And there is clearly a question of, does the court have jurisdiction to strike remand orders? That's his determination here. Okay. We can read in and says, because he doesn't even say the entry of the order to divest the court of jurisdiction. He quotes low.
Well, he's quoting low. In the first sentence, he says the court has no jurisdiction to grant that request.
And that request is the only request that's being asked. Yeah. That's exactly correct.
But you can't have jurisdiction. If the court is divested of jurisdiction, it's divested of jurisdiction. It's not piecemeal. It either has jurisdiction or it doesn't.
They don't dribble back
in motions.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, under Cooter and Gale, they make a distinction. And they say that Rule 11 sanctions may be considered even after dismissal. And here's after a remand, and we concede that there would be jurisdiction for Rule 11 sanctions. And I don't think Judge Nickerson found otherwise.
So isn't it an all or nothing proposition that the court could only have jurisdiction over the whole matter, or is it what he is saying, I have jurisdiction over this, but to give that relief, I don't have jurisdiction to give you that relief. Is that something he could say?
No. I believe so, Your Honor.
If you can't say, I don't have the jurisdiction to give you the relief you're being asked, Then maybe jurisdiction is not the right word. He doesn't have the authority.
Under Cooter and Gale, he would have jurisdiction to do Rule 11 sanctions, but not a request for modification of the order.
So under 1447D, which you rely on, an order remanding a case to the state court from which it was removed is not reviewable. And in Relo, review includes reconsideration by the district court. What I understood the district court to say, based on that whole paragraph, is that he was divested of jurisdiction to review or reconsider or do anything with respect to what remained. There wasn't anything that remained. The entry of the remand order took the case away and sent it to state court.
It didn't. I don't think the order could be fairly read as saying that it took away the right for Rule 11 sanctions. What he said there was
term ancillary jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, Judge.
Don't you want to use the term ancillary jurisdiction?
If you say so.
I mean, there's ancillary jurisdiction for a federal district judge to do any number of things: review a cost order, impose Rule 11 sanctions. Right?
Well,
I mean, that's the term of art.
Cooter and Gell, I believe, recognize this. And Judge Nickerson did not say he didn't have jurisdiction for Rule 11 sanctions.
You just said that, though. You told me right here. You answered my question. You said he didn't have jurisdiction. And I said, and you said he did not have jurisdiction. And I said, are you confusing jurisdiction and authority? You didn't buy that line. You arguing no jurisdiction. That's what you've argued. You answered my question 4 or 5 minutes ago.
No jurisdiction for vacator under Rule 60B3.
It's not a jurisdictional
thing. What does that
thing
mean?
That's
not, let me say this much. That is not a term of art.
And I shouldn't have used it in my panel opinion. And that's why we're here. That's exactly right. It's a terrible opinion.
I don't know if it's a terrible opinion.
It's a terrible opinion.
Okay. So can we go home now?
Let me ask you this question. It's a hypothetical question. I'm trying to understand your view of the law. Hypothetical. It's not the facts in this case. What if a party obtains remand by absolute fraud, but nobody knows it till after the fact? Is the party who committed fraud on the federal court insulated as far as the litigation itself from anything the court can do?
Apart from getting disbarred?
No. Under Cooter and Gell, there may be Rule 11 sanctions. Absolutely. There may not be, or if the motion involves...
What do you read 60B as providing? Just 60B is a general proposition. What does it do?
60B3 requires, as a precondition to relief, proof or proffer of a meritorious defense.
What's it say? The language? Just read the language of B3. It doesn't have anything about that.
The Schultz case gives the 3%.
What's Rule 60B? What's Rule 60 all about? It's about relief from judgment. Relief from a judgment or order. Doesn't say anything about vacature or anything like that.
Or defenses. It talks about fraud, based on fraud.
The court may relieve a party or its legal representative from a final judgment, order, or proceeding for fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by an opposing party.
Now, what's that mean?
Relief. It's not to say a thing about vacature. Just because you get relief.
Your Honors, the focus on the word fraud points out that I'd like to point out that the AIDS counseling case, the Fourth Circuit case, says that fraudulent joinder is a term of art. It does not reflect on the integrity of plaintiff
that
or counsel.
That doesn't address 60B3, does it? I mean, our questions are focusing, you're unwilling to address the role and function of 60B3. It's a wild card which says that nothing becomes settled that's committed on fraud. You can go 50 years after a judgment and open it up if fraud is discovered.
True, Your Honor, but with regard to the interplay
between... Fraud on the court is a pretty serious thing. It's the theory behind it is what I always thought.
Absolutely.
And the lawyers, there's a duty of candor to the court. You can't have lawyers shopping different rounds and committing fraud. Now, whether they did here or not, I don't know, but the courts have a right to try to figure it out.
Absolutely. And it's the interplay between 60B3 and 1447D that precludes and Judge Nickerson correctly ruled so, that because of the meritorious defense requirement of 60B3, that precludes a...
Maybe it all does come down to what Judge Davis said a while ago, is which one of those two things trump. The 60B3 relief from judgment that's authorized for fraud, or this thing about 1447, where he says you can't get a review.
I agree.
Whether they're mutually exclusive and which one takes precedent.
I agree, Your Honor. And
Judge Davis thought one thing, and Judge Floyd thought another at the panel hearing. We got to figure it out.
What's wrong with sending the case back to the district judge and saying just that? You have jurisdiction, make a ruling on the merits, if that, whether or not you can give relief. And if he may say, well, y'all apparently didn't read my order because that's what I said, but you'll at least get it. We'll have it straight. We'll know what he did.
What's wrong with that, Your Honor, is that in order to do that, the court would first have to consider the elements under the Schultz test of 60B3, including the meritorious defense requirement, and in doing so would necessarily...
What do you keep coming up with this meritorious defense under 60B3?
Nothing in there.
Under the Schultz case, the three-part test for 60B3 relief under the Schultz Fourth Circuit case.
But Schultz talks about relief for judgments that were unfairly procured. That's the gist of the Schultz case. And they're not... 60B3 is to determine whether or not... The matter was remanded and it was unfairly procured by fraud or misrepresentation. That's
and it requires proffer of a meritorious defense, and that this court's decision, a judgment call on whether there was a meritorious defense of fraudulent judgment, fraudulent joinder, runs smack into
the prohibition. You're talking about fraudulent joinder. I never understood whether that had anything to do much with fraudulent joinder. It's about lawyers committing fraud on the court. Fraud on the court, misrepresentation and lying to the court.
And there
even
was
with respect to an order that's not reviewable. So a lawyer stands in front of the court and tells outright lies, and he knows they're outright lies, and it's demonstrable. The court doesn't know it. So the court enters a remand order, which, and then it comes back for review when the fraud is uncovered, and you're saying the court can't correct that because it's not reviewable under the otherwise clause.
Well, that's right, Your Honor.
That's what you're saying?
There can be sanctions under Rule 11, but not vacator under Rule 60B3 because
I'm
of the...
I'm not talking about a vacator. I'm talking about the court issues an order, hypothetical order, based on a fraudulent misrepresentations of an attorney. And it's pretty clearly fraudulent. Court acts on the basis of that fraud and doesn't know about it. And then the victim, the other party, comes in and says, hold it, this order was obtained by fraud. I'd like to have it set aside under 60B3 because of the fraud. And you come in and say, oh, no, court, you can't review it because it's not reviewable.
It's not reviewable? Yeah. It's,
that's what you'd say, right?
There can be Rule 11 sanctions, but not 60B3 sanctions under that hypothetical.
The idea that a company required to litigate a defense in state court rather than federal court is a victim of anything is pretty remarkable.
I'd like to address the merits and in terms of whether in fact there was any improper procurement.
I do believe you have your red light. How long have you had that red light on? We don't give tickets, but we do stop you.
10 minutes.
Your Honor, may I beg the court's indulgence for the 1 point?
30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The improper procurement argument relies on a false premise that plaintiffs represented their subjective intent to the district court. They did not, and that's because the only inquiry was whether there was a glimmer of hope standard satisfied. And that's all that was addressed. There was never a representation of intent to pursue. That would require a flipping
that.
Of the burden of proof under fraudulent joinder, which is always on the defendant.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Gay.
First of all, Your Honor, to correct one thing, on whether we could remove now, there's a one-year limit on diversity removal, which was long past by the time this was discovered. In terms of Rule 60B3, the questions the court asked.
We're way beyond the year?
Way beyond a year, yes, way beyond a year. And in terms of Rule 60B3, the test is on, you know, not whether the outcome was changed, not reviewing the merits, but on whether the judgment was unfairly procured. And when Judge Davis refers to going back to looking at the fraud again, revisiting the fraud, we're not talking about the fraudulent joinder. We're talking about, as Judge King mentioned, the fraud on the court, the fraud of in one court saying we are going to pursue, there is a glimmer of hope, we're going to pursue these defendants, and the next week going to the state court.
I don't know whether there was any fraud on the court or not, but that's what I think the rule talks about.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Rule 60B3, I mean, they could have been telling the truth to the federal court and lying to the state court, in which case there wouldn't be any fraud here, I guess. I mean,
well,
you just say they're lying here because they lied over there or because it's inconsistent over there.
And when just
maybe they're telling the truth one place.
Well, to be clear.
Or maybe both of them are, maybe they're just inconsistent.
Well,
or maybe it's two different lawyers and they misremembered.
Judge, it's the same two lawyers in a very small firm who knew exactly what they were doing.
Maybe they got a good explanation.
And with regard to Judge Davis's point that these were just written representations, that is not the case. Both in writing and orally to the state court immediately after, a week thereafter.
What I was referring to was what you have highlighted in your arguments was a pleading filed in state court. And then at the hearing, the second lawyer, I understand you disagree with the characterization, but the second lawyer, according to the plaintiffs here, the appellees, clarified what was intended by that statement in the pleading. Now, if that's wrong,
Judge Davis, with all due respect, it couldn't be more wrong. If you could just bear.
So you're saying that first statement about was not in a motion paper in the state court, filed in the state
both
court?
Both in writing and before the state court.
Well, you keep saying
judge.
Both. The but, first statement, the statement that you highlight in your papers,
both
came
of
out of a pleading.
One of them did, and one of them was said
the
orally.
The first one was in a pleading.
The first one
and then
said,
at the oral hearing, the lawyer clarified.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Okay. Absolutely not. Right. Both in both the pleading and in state court, the plaintiff said this
but
is a.
We're talking about the state court. I'm talking about the pleading in state court.
Yes.
Okay.
And both of those statements were, this is a one defendant case. There is no evidence, not even a suggestion of evidence against any defendant.
And when Judge Glenn questioned the lawyer, it's right here in the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
The lawyer said she misspoke. It's a different standard.
Absolutely not.
Okay. I'm imagining the record.
No, the record, if I can just be clear on that, Your Honor, is it could not be clearer. On page A863 and A476 of the record, the state court representation, there's absolutely no evidence to indicate or even suggest that plaintiffs were exposed to asbestos by anybody except Colgate. On the record in state court, agreed with the state court judge that this is a one defendant case. On the record in state court.
And what was relied on in federal court was deposition testimony by the plaintiff and an inference drawn from that testimony about whether one or both of the plaintiffs had been exposed at work because of this government contract. I understand your advocacy. I don't blame you for trying to keep it as narrow as possible.
But the lawyer
in federal court drew an inference from her client's deposition testimony that she was at a work site where certain of your client's products may have been used to suggest to the federal court that we may have a glimmer of hope.
Absolutely.
And as you said, there was no oral hearing in federal court. Judge Quarles and Judge Nickerson decided to grant the motion to remand. And they get back to state court and in front of Judge Glenn, they say, well, we made that argument over there, but this is now a one defendant case. And you adopted the argument that they had made in federal court, essentially.
No, Your Honor.
It's all tactics, Ms. Gay. We understand that.
No, Your Honor.
It's regrettable that I wrote such a terrible opinion. I won't say that again. They're tired of hearing it.
Judge Davis, if I may
respond. But it's clear that your client wanted to be back in federal court, and Judge Nickerson said, I don't have jurisdiction to grant that relief. He didn't say it with the alacrity and the erudition that we might like, but that's exactly what he said. That's exactly what he said.
Your Honor.
He knows full well he could have imposed a fine of $10,000 on these lawyers. He could have sent these lawyers to the district court's admission and disciplinary committee. He could send, just as you could, he could send a complaint to the Maryland Attorney Grievance Commission saying these lawyers have committed fraud on the court. He could have done any of those things.
Your Honor.
And neither you nor your firm nor your client, nor Judge Quarles, nor Judge Nickerson did any of those things, because this is the normal fight between defendants who want to be in federal court and the plaintiffs who want to keep them in state court. It happens every day. There's nothing special about this case.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and may I respond?
Yes, of course.
I hope and pray it doesn't happen every day that in federal court, someone says they are intending to pursue certain defendants, and they walk across the street and they say, this is a one defendant case. I have never seen it happen. I cannot imagine that that happens every day.
It happens every day.
Well, if it does, it happens every day. It cannot be that this court nor the federal district court is without ability when there is fraud procured that procures a judgment to grant relief. It cannot be so. It cannot be that any rule trumps this court's ability when what is a blatant misrepresentation is put to there. There was no correction. In fact, every time there has been a correction, as Judge Floyd points out, the plaintiffs go deeper and deeper and deeper. They said
Yes. I think we take your point that there's some disagreement. You started to do it, maybe you've done it. I just want to hear your legal argument in response to what the other side said. That's for me. I'd like to hear that. And I think I've heard it. It cannot be that when fraud is used to procure something in federal court, the federal courts have no authority to do anything about it. That's your argument. Anything else you want to add?
Well,
to that?
Yeah, absolutely. 1447 does not preclude this court or any federal court from addressing fraud on the court. Nor have we asked for review of the remand order. We have asked for, under Rule 60B3, and we have made a sufficient showing that there was fraud procured in the actual order itself, which was the remand order. And we've made the three-prong showing that we were required to make.
Do you think the district court felt it had authority under 60B3, it had jurisdiction under 60B3 or not?
I believe the court erroneously felt that 1447 prohibited it considering the Rule 60B3 relief.
That's not answering my question.
Okay.
Do you think that the district court felt it had jurisdiction to entertain a 60B3 motion, to entertain the motion?
I don't think so because of 1447. That's how I read that order, Your Honor. And just to be clear, that the showing
that... Winding up?
Yes, this would be the last point. The Schultz case is dispositive here, the Fourth Circuit Schultz case, which does lay out the three elements of a 60B3 showing, none of which require reconsideration of the merits. They require a showing that a fair hearing was deprived and that there was fraud, not fraudulent joinder, Judge Davis, but fraud in the context of the hearing itself. And that was missed in the court below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Gay.
We'll adjourn court for the day, come down and greet counsel.